Today's episode contains some salty language, courtesy of Bono, which is fine for me, but may not be suitable for all listeners. Hi, I'm Rashida Jones.
Hi, I'm Bill Gates.
And we're here to ask the big questions.
Can we just talk? Can we just talk?
Today, the big question is, can people really change? Can Trump supporters learn to accept and maybe even respect President Joe Biden? Will this pandemic ever unify us as opposed to dividing us? So, talking about personal change and making change in the world and how those two things are connected. In terms of the work that you do and how you've tried to precipitate change, do you feel like there were things when you were young that were extremely important to you and that you prioritized that have changed?
Yeah, I'd say that I'm more interested in other people. I was quite self-centered when I was young in, am I talented? What can I do with my talent?
I think we all do that.
You know, computers, but I was an extreme case.
Okay, I believe you.
Can I write the best software? What can we do with personal computing? I definitely think age, for me, has made me think about other people way more than I was able to when I was young.
Okay, so what would 18-year-old Bill see about Bill today that would surprise him?
You know, I'd say this guy is lazy. He takes a lot of vacation. He's not as sharp as he used to be.
That's so sad. You think your young self would look at this guy and be like, what is he doing? Get to work, buddy.
Yeah, just goofing off. But of course, I didn't. And when I was 18, I didn't have high expectations for what I would do in my 60s because, you know, I didn't think of people in their 60s as being relevant to the fast-moving, high IQ game that I was in. And there weren't older people because it was kind of a new field. So I wouldn't expect myself to still be at the cutting edge or at all. But I was pretty tough on how lazy most people were.
And now you're one of those people.
You bet.
Congratulations.
Yeah, I'm headed off. I'm going to take the weekend off. I mean,
whoa.
How do you think you've changed over time?
I think, you know, I don't remember if it's like a Churchill quote or something. It's like, if you're conservative when you're young, you're heartless. If you're liberal when you're older, you're stupid or something. That's not it. That's a paraphrase. But I think I was much more radical when I was younger about how change was possible. And I remember having conversations with my dad. My dad is he's got this kind of diplomatic vibe about him where he can kind of talk to anybody. And it's such a beautiful quality that I understand and I respect so much more now as an adult than I did then, because I would consider somebody who was philosophically opposed to me when I was younger an enemy. And now I've accepted the inherent flawed nature of being human and being on this planet. And I think there's something about that that maybe, hopefully, makes me more effective in being a part of change. So maybe that's how I've changed. I'm just less radical. And I'm a little bit more, I'm softer on the edges in the sense that, like, I just, when people make mistakes, like, they make mistakes. I make mistakes. It's just part of being alive, you know? We're not computers. Sorry, Bill, but we're not. So I was always brought up with this idea that I do have a responsibility to the world, that I can't just take and take and take and ask people to look at me and look at me and not give back. And the more that I get, the more I have to give back. And I think that's because I did get a lot of love and attention from two people who care a lot about the world. And just the fact that my parents were in an interracial relationship at a time when it wasn't very common was a political act within itself. And I think being born from that, I feel a responsibility to continue to help evolve the conversation around identity and inequality and all that stuff. Do you feel, Bill, like you probably got to a place where you made your money and then thought, okay, I have to dedicate this money to other people's suffering. But is that something that was instilled in you from a very young age, or was there like a turning point in your success?
No, my parents were always great role models for what my dad called showing up. and being part of community activities. And I knew that I was super lucky to have two great parents, to go to an amazing school. And so that's partly why my naivete about, as Melinda and I took our first trip to Africa and saw the human condition there, it was like, boy, I need to learn about this. Mm. I have been sheltered, but I do have the role model from my parents.
What was your first trip to Africa?
We went before we got married. It was incredible. 1993, Melinda convinced me to take a vacation at a time when that I was just getting used to that.
You weren't lazy yet.
You know, we went, we thought, oh, we'll go see animals. But in fact, what we saw were people, you know, working so hard and dealing with shortages. And that kind of kicked off. You know, we got married within a year of that and said, okay, one of the things we're going to do together is take this wealth and dedicate it to those things, including however much learning we can do. So my parents had seeded that, as had Melinda's.
So turning more to kind of what happened during this election, I think a lot of people became aware of how different the thought processes and the philosophies of people in this country are. And I wonder, do you think you can actually change hearts and minds? Like, do you think there's people that can see somebody else who has a have completely different political views and be changed? Or understand the way their enemy thinks?
Well, yeah, the word enemy, that's a strong word.
Okay, okay, opponent.
Now, the polarization, you know, you sometimes you do shake your head, but then you have to think, okay, there's a variety of attitudes that people have that are hard to change and drive that kind of tribal vote. But yes, I'm worried. Every time I say I should reach out and understand that side better, I find myself falling short.
Do you think that exposure, when we talk about this great polarity and the rise of nationalism all over the world, do you think that exposure is the answer to the problem? Like, if you got to see more people in different circumstances, are you less likely to be xenophobic or nationalistic, or are you more likely to be empathetic?
Absolutely. I think the chance of world wars is less because we get to know people from all over. And so the whole idea of go there, meet people from that location, understand their point of view, you know, I hope the digital world is facilitating that. And, and that's why I hope, you know, we won't have conflagrations like World War II in the future. So yes, exposure is key.
You know, I've noticed on my social media, the conflict in Nigeria right now, I know about that because I have a lot of Nigerian American friends, and I also have friends who just happen to be interested in that. So I do feel like that's one positive thing about social media and the internet, is that I have more access to that information because it's flowing through my group of friends and the people who do care about that kind of thing. So that's kind of a good thing. But I also think that maybe the pandemic has exacerbated this feeling because there is not as much travel. Like, I find it very expansive to travel. You know, I know I don't represent everybody, but we don't have that access right now. So it does feel like everybody's sort of hunkering down and doubling down on their own feelings about what's right and what's worth fighting for.
Now, it'll be good to get out again, even though there may be less trips. Those trips will be important to connect.
Right.
I hope post the pandemic, that kind of outreach is broad. You know, after the World War, the world came together and created the United Nations. And I think we'll see some of that now. We need some people speaking up for the benefits of cooperation.
Do you think that where we are now, are we so damaged that it's going to be so hard to fix? Like, do you think we need to go further in the extreme direction before we fix it?
No. No, in fact, I'm not a radical or revolutionary, and I worry that people see radical solutions as the only way to move forward, whereas I see more centrist ways of being able to tackle problems, not overnight, but I don't think the radical approach works overnight as well. So the, you know, the extreme views, yeah, that's a bit scary.
Yeah, because I wonder what it's going to be that unifies us. I mean, if it's not going to be a pandemic and it's not going to be politics, what is it actually going to be? I mean, you know, I believe that art can be a great unifier. I believe that humor can be a great unifier. Music can be a great unifier. And our guest today is not only a world-famous musician, but he's also worked tirelessly to use his voice and influence to impact real change in the world. I want to welcome to the show the man that Bill most wants to hug when COVID is over, Bono. Welcome, Bono.
Well, hello there, Rashida. Hello there, Bill. I got the message that Bill wanted to mug me, not hug me. And it's usually the other way around, so I'm very relieved and moved, actually. And that shouldn't be shocking. That's the Bill Gates I know.
He may still mug you while he's hugging you. That's his trick, I've heard.
No, it's usually the other way around. People are constantly bothering this man for access to his wallet, when in fact it's his brain is where the real resources lie. That's what I'd say.
Well, that's nice. How did you two first meet? I want to know the meet cute story.
There was a meeting in New York pre-Davos. There was some hamburgers involved. This is long before Impossible Burger and Good For You Burgers. It was definitely Bad For You Burgers situation. And I thought, I'm going to get along with this man very well. And then I think the next night we had a meeting of activists, and there was a bunch of us at the back of a restaurant. There was a knock on the door, and eventually I went, opened it, and there was a kind of a rapper standing there, and I recognized him to be Puffy, but Bill had no idea who this man was. And when he came in and came straight up and just went, "Bill Gates, you are a motherfucker." And Bill just like was looking at me like, "What's
like,
going
is
on?
That good?"
And he said, What you're doing on malaria is off the charts." And we had a kind of great evening.
That's a very good story. We've also, full disclosure, we've known each other a very long time because our families know each other. And you're very close with my dad, who loves you kind of more than, not more than me, but more than a lot of people in the world. So,
well, can I say, Rashida, that I remember the first time I met you, and you probably don't know this, but you are one of the reasons that Ali and myself have kids, because I guess you would have been, you know, maybe 11, 12, 13. I can't recall exactly. I was round in your house with Ali, and we watched you with your father, and it was just a very, very affectionate occasion, and you were playing with him, sort of slapping him on the face, and he's pushing you away. And it was kind of like, "You're a nuisance." And he goes, like, "You know, who's the nuisance?" And I walked with Ali afterwards, and I said, "You know, maybe it is possible to have kids and be a musician, you know, where you give yourself to your music." I mean, it was a real conversation about, because I wasn't sure I could be a good parent. And a month or so later, Ali was pregnant.
That's so nice. And that actually is very relevant to our conversation today, because we were talking about personal change and also world change. And are those things possible? And how much do you change, and how much can you change other people? Hearing you talk about how you probably had a fixed idea of what your life would be like because you're a musician, and then you have this moment and it kind of changes your idea of whether or not you can be a father. You think you know who you are, and then the world kind of tells you differently. So I want to know from you, Bono, you grew up in Ireland and very difficult time, and you just seem like somebody who is inherently an activist. And I'm not sure which came first for you, the artistry or the activism, but how does how you came up inform the kind of activist that you are?
Well, I'm sure the desire to be in a band was just megalomania starting at a very early age. You know, you just want to be heard, because probably you're being ignored at home. I mean, there's two ways I think you become an artist. One is by being told by your family that you're incredible and you've got something, you've got a lot to say. And the other is by just being completely ignored. And I'm the latter there, and I've more than made up for it. And, you know, my father was, even though he had low tolerance of me, he had a lot of other smart things about him. One of them was this, he was deeply suspect of nationalism. Mm. And he used to quote, "What is Ireland? What is Ireland but the place that keeps my feet from getting wet?" Mm. And this was at a time in Ireland when a sectarian strife was pulling the country apart. We were in Ireland, north and south, were nearly in civil war. He was a Catholic, my mother was a Protestant. And he taught me to see through that and indeed to see through religion. And he played a huge role in my life. And he actually, he said of me, even as I did quite well with you too, he used to ask me, when was I going to get a real job? And he'd say, you know, son, he said, you are a baritone who thinks he's a tenor. And I realized that was really true. And I have been sort of stretching out of my skin ever since. But I think for me, it definitely started with a sort of sense of rage at injustice. And that's propelled the early punk rock of U2.
Bono, you've known Bill for a really long time. How do you think Bill's changed?
Well, I don't know if you know the Seamus Heaney poem, Republic of Conscience, but there's this phrase, creeping privilege, and it haunts me, actually. I watch out for it in myself. I've never seen that in Bill Gates. It's just a strange thing. From the very first days when I was trying to put my hand in his wallet like everybody else for the purposes of activism, but I've never seen that. But what I have seen change, or maybe it's just that I've uncovered it, but I found him to be very relaxed and funny and dark sense of humor, and which I was kind of the naughty boy in the class, which I wasn't expecting. Because we'd be at meetings with, you know, whatever finance ministers, and I can't believe Bill Gates has just whispered that in my ear. So maybe more relaxed about his public persona, but still pretty intense on the mission, whatever that mission is. And we argue all the time. Our manager, Paul McGuinness, used to always say, you're as good as the arguments you get. And Bill Gates is pretty good in a row. And we can go at it because we just want to get to the right place.
Right.
And I think that's, again, I need it. I hope Bill enjoys it as much as me.
Bill, do you enjoy getting in a row with Bono?
Absolutely. I mean, the sad thing about our meeting was that Bono had been trying to meet me for a number of years, and my co-founder of Microsoft, Paul Allen, was in the music world, unlike myself, and he kept saying, hey, Bono wants to meet with you. And I was like, oh, God, you know, he's not going to know much. And so I delayed. It was a couple years running there. And then when I met Bono and I saw his passion and his understanding of how to express the injustice of the way things were, that was so much fun. My favorite story is that Bono was saying to President Bush that something about the HIV emergency should be done, and came up and said, yeah, we're going to get at least $5 billion a year, which will really make a difference. And I was like, you're going to get what? That is the craziest thing I have ever heard. And it came true. It actually happened. And it was that audacity that it's just, so why not go for it, even though something like that had never happened? You know, we've gotten off to a great start where sometimes our work, people see it and it feels relevant, and sometimes the world feels like they're not paying attention at all. And so we get to share that sense of, oh gosh, we have to keep this in front of people. And how do you make it interesting? How do you activate their brain and their heart? Mm. Bono's taught me a lot about that.
That's cool. Yeah, because I do feel, Bono, you are incredibly poetic and articulate on things that maybe seem like inner machinations or behind the scenes, and bringing those things to the general public. How much do you think talking about it is going to help inform them. Do you know what I mean?
Well, certainly our politics is a product of storytelling. Poor storytelling brings about poor politics. And I consider myself to be top-line melody person. It might surprise you that I don't just look for that top-line melody in music. I'm looking for it in ideas, in the world of ideas. I'm looking for it in politics and activism all over the place. Mm. But Bill is also, you don't think of him as singer, but he's also looking for that clear thought. Mm. And in fact, he's very singular in his focus, trying to find that thing. What's that thing that will get us through this? And that we have in common. But actually, the storytelling, to answer your question, Rashida, the storytelling has become really important in the last years, because in a time of fables, we need truth tellers. Mm. And whereas, Rashida, you and I, we look for, I suppose, as an actor or as a performer. Bill's not a performer. I'm a performer. I'm looking for emotional integrity of a thought. But a truth teller, it has to be intellectual honesty. Mm. And it just, for this period, our best storytellers are truth tellers. You don't think of Tony Fauci, who you've had on this podcast, as a singer. He's fucking Frank Sinatra to me. And so,
just clear, cutting right to it, right?
Well, yeah, it's just that's what we need in our storytelling.
Right.
I hope that we're always smart enough to remind people that we belong to the human race. That's the nation that we should think of ourselves being part of. Bono and I went to a dinner one night in London where one of our colleagues said to us, you know, this thing you do about saving children's lives, that's really not an interesting idea right now. That's sort of passé. And I remember I got fairly angry at the dinner saying, how can you say that? I mean, the person was actually trying to help us, and it was kind of true that our
the messaging
melody
maybe,
or whatever, right, was not resonating.
Right.
But he said it like, oh, you have to find another cause. And
no one cares about children anymore.
No, damn it, we need another melody, not another cause. Do you remember that, Bono?
I remember it well. And I'm really glad that you, for all of the sights you've seen on the ground, in the field, that you've not lost your sense of annoyance. And indeed, that's the wrong word, rage. I would call it rage.
Yeah.
And you know, the thing about, if I can say this, and I am going to say it, which is, if people talk about Bill's capability, but I would rather I talk about his character. Mm. And the reason that I'm friends as opposed to just comrades with Bill is because of the values. And I think it's good that you're annoyed, Bill. That's my point. I'm the punk rocker going, I think I know what he meant. And Bill's going, I don't want to know what he meant.
I actually have a personal question because it applies to me too. And I have a much smaller fan base and maybe a much smaller circle of influence. But I do find that I get criticized sometimes for being too political or, you know, talking about things that people don't want me to talk about. They want me to, whatever, shut up and act or shut up and do whatever. But Bono, do you ever feel like people reach a point of fatigue when it comes to artists talking about social justice issues? Like, do you ever feel like it's time to shut up? Because I feel like that sometimes.
Most of my family would concur. And would concur.
This is an intervention. They actually called me to call you to be like, please stop talking.
Yeah. No, it's yeah, is the answer. I would quite like to actually reduce my profile in this kind of way, but it's what else use is this currency of that we've been given, this fame? I hate the word celebrity. It's, I would say celebrity upends God's order of things, and mothers and nurses and people. It's like, these are the really important things. So you might think singers love the sound of their own voice. Why else would they be out there? But actually, people step onto a stage to try and find their voice. It's the strangest thing. And you're actually trying to find out who you are. Art is an attempt to identify yourself. And hopefully, when that job is done, you can fuck off.
You know, the eloquence to draw people in and not have it repel them because you're telling them bad news and it's about people who are far away. The eloquence to draw people in, Bono is so gifted. You know, when he sat down with Senator Helms, when he went over to Tony Fauci's house and said, now's the time, we've got to get this done. I mean, it made a huge difference. And the work that Bono drove through won, and his personal voice, even saying things like, hey, the U.S. is an idea of equality, and that he admires that, that's gotten a lot of people to step back and say, okay, this is important. I'd say celebrity activism, I'd use Bono's work as Exhibit A to say that it really can make a difference. And now we have a U.S. administration that will care, and we have a crisis we got to finish off. So, you know, no slacking off.
Not yet.
Anytime soon.
Yeah.
Right. I have a burning question for Bill, which is, what is your favorite U2 song?
You know, I might say One, or I might say Sunday Bloody Sunday. There are so many good U2 songs.
It's pretty crazy.
And more to come.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And you can be sure, Rashida, that you'll be seeing more of the two of us in service of our activism.
Bono, thank you so much for joining us and being here with us. And it's just been an absolute pleasure. And please continue to do your work.
The same to you, Rashida. We are ever in your debt. And thanks for this podcast, both of you. This will get us through what could be a tough winter.
Tough winter.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bono. Say hi to your family.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Well, it feels a little funny to introduce Kerry Washington because she is my friend. I feel very honored to call her my friend, but I'm going to do it anyway. So she is a film and television actress known for her work as Olivia Pope in Scandal, as well as films like Ray, Django Unchained, and Confirmation, where she played Anita Hill. But as much as Kerry has accomplished on screen, she devotes a lot of her time and her platform to advocating for civil liberties, voting rights, gender equality, especially empowerment of Black women and girls, ending police brutality, and much, much, much more. I'm very excited to have her here today. So welcome, Kerry.
Thank you, Rashida. Thank you for having me, my dear.
This is Bill Gates.
Hey,
Hi,
Kerry.
Hi, Bill Gates.
Have you ever met the two of you?
Not in person. I've seen a lot of those works, including I love Scandal. So.
Big Scandalhead.
Thank you.
So we've been talking a lot today about change and if people can really change and where change starts. I'll say I bristle when somebody puts activists in front of my name. And I think that's because I know so many real on-the-ground activists who've committed their life and their life's work to that. Do you consider yourself an activist? It's not a trick question, I promise. I just want to talk about it. Do you consider yourself an activist, and what does that mean to you?
Yeah, I'm with you. I think that there are people who dedicate their entire lives to the work of activism. Recently, when I was on the campaign trail, somebody called me an artivist.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, I get that.
Sounds a
I'll
little bit like
that.
A prescription for allergies,
yes,
but I'll take
exactly.
it.
Big side effects. because I do think I am really passionate about being able to impact change where I can, when I can, but I know that I'm not a full-time change maker.
Yeah. But do you think that when it comes to impacting people and affecting change, because this is a question I ask myself too, like we talked to Bono about this particularly, do you feel the fatigue that people feel hearing from you on matters that are not art related? Because I certainly do. And what do you do to battle that?
I think a big part of why I don't often feel that fatigue is that I've always done this work, right? Like it has, for some reason, I've been really vocal about issues that determine or that involve humanity from the very beginning of my career. So I don't often get a lot of pushback about it because it really is a part of how I walk in the world. And I think that's really important when we start thinking about artists having more of a voice, because I think sometimes what happens is we pop up in these election years, right? And every 4 years we come around and want to have a voice and an impact. And if we're not living in that space, not to the same degree, right? Like, we don't have to be in serious get out the vote mode. But if we're not sort of acknowledging the struggles of humanity and a little bit focused on change and doing good in the world in the off years and on the off seasons, then I think people bristle at it because it feels out of context.
Yeah, and inauthentic.
Mm-hmm. And so when we say to a celebrity, like, you should not be political, we're actually living in opposition to the reality that we all need to be political. Mm. We shouldn't tell anybody to not be engaged. Democracy requires us all. It's not a spectator sport.
Where does that come from for you? Is that from your parents? Like, why is that so built into the fabric of who you are?
I think so. I think my parents are both pretty engaged in the community in different ways. Like, my dad is more of the, like, work from within the system guy. He's on, like, so many different boards, community boards, healthcare boards. You know, I come from New York City, so, you know, this healthcare board in the Bronx and that community service board in Brooklyn. And so he does a lot of that kind of work. And my mother was much more of an activist growing up. Like, she crossed the line when the teachers' union was picketing. She crossed the picket line because she thought that a lot of what the union was standing for was racist and sexist. And so she's always been more of an activist. Yeah.
That's it's tough to cross that line. Woof. With a union? Ooh.
Mm-hmm. When I was a kid, my public school was downstairs from the superintendent's office. And the superintendent used to always say to me in the hallway, like, did your mommy drop you at school today? And I thought that it was because, like, he really liked my mom. But it's because he was terrified of her. And he knew that if she was around, he was going to have to answer to some of her questions.
She didn't? Great. I feel much better. Yes, enjoy exactly. your day, sweetheart.
Exactly.
We were talking about what it means to, like, construct a narrative and storytelling. And Bono was saying he's a top melody writer. That's what he does. He kind of comes in, he, like, distills what the issue is and tries to communicate it to the rest of the world.
Mm.
So do you, Carrie, do you see your work the way that Bono does, which is essentially just trying to help communicate key issues?
I really try to think about this work strategically because I do think sometimes as artists, we get told to, like, just have feelings about things and particularly as actors, right? Like, just sing a song about it or just make a movie about it. And I think there's incredible power in that, in, like, impacting culture through narrative. But I also think as activists, because we're storytellers, we can hear their larger issues and translate it into words that other people can hear, particularly somebody like you, right? As a writer, my job as an actor, your job as an actor, like, we walk in other people's shoes. So I think I'm often able to, like, hear something and say, how would that person hear that best? Or how would that community understand that issue? Or what does this group of women need to hear in order to activate around that issue?
How integrated do you think your career and your activism are? Would you, like, seek out certain roles because that would reinforce the values you bring to your activism?
So it's funny. It more came up for me early in my career. I started realizing that I was saying no to projects at a time when I could not afford to say no to anything. But I remember saying, I'd rather work 3 more shifts at this restaurant than take on a movie that I think is going to be bad for women or reinforce stereotypes about Black people. So occasionally I'm drawn to something because I feel like, oh, this is a message that needs to be out in the world. But more often, the weird reality is that for me, because I'm a woman and because I'm a Black person, any time that I've put myself at the center of a story or found myself at the center of a story, it's somewhat of a political act. So my job has just been to, like, really three-dimensionalize that person and make her fully human, which is my job as an actor anyway. But in this body, it's really important because for Olivia Pope, for example, so many people said to me, like, she was the Black woman that I've been closest to in my life. Like, I've never had a Black woman in my house every single week right. at the same right. time and had that kind of intimacy the way I did with
for
Olivia
white
Pope.
People and Black people, right?
Yeah. Yes, yes, totally.
And there is something that's inherently political about playing that role and reaching so many people, because it does just sort of fill out the spectrum of what you understand a Black woman to be.
Yeah, yeah. And not interpreting that to mean like I have to be perfect, but interpreting, you know, one of the things I loved about her was she was so aspirational, but she was massively yeah. flawed, you know, sleeping with somebody else's husband, like all that stuff.
The so, president, but whatever.
Whatever.
Not just somebody else's husband. Okay. Relatable, relatable.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I wanted to ask you kind of what the things are that you are most focused on when it comes to this present moment and then your big, big wishes for the world.
I think one of the other things that Bono does so well and that I think is really important is really shining a light on folks on the ground who are doing the work and not saying like, I have all the answers, I have all the information, but sort of saying to our community and our eyeballs, our millions of eyeballs, I'm so happy I have your attention. Now look over here at this other real activist, as you pointed out earlier, Rashida, who's doing the work. You know, listen to her, follow her. Let me stand next to her so that the cameras stay rolling while you take in her messaging. So that's also been a big part of my commitment to the work.
Yeah,
but I do think narrative is really important. I was actually thinking this morning about, Bill, the TED Talk that you did years ago about the next great virus, you know, the next big challenge. And here we are, right? And I think it's so important, like having that narrative at that point really helps us understand the mistakes we made and really gives us And obviously, the folks in power, like government officials, had those tools, but gives us as a public a greater understanding of what we can do differently and even how to trust science when it's presented to us.
Bill and I were speaking about this earlier. You know, we have a very formidable divide in this country, and I don't expect you mm-hmm. to have the answer to that, Carrie, but in the face of that,
I expect Bill to.
I do too.
That's what I came here too. For.
But in the face of that, do you think we are capable of changing hearts and minds? And how does that, what does that look like? How does that start to happen?
I really think that there's going to have to be some real transformation in our education system to help young people understand the dynamics at play and to be able to understand the media with more authority and agency, you know, to be able to filter out news
media
from
literacy.
Fiction. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. And so like we just need to have people really be seen and heard and understand that it's not a zero-sum game, that my piece of the pie doesn't take away from your piece of pie, and then make that the reality through legislation so that really people do have enough access to healthcare and education and the resources that they need so that we don't create zero-sum dynamics. Mm. I mean, it's just there has to be a real long game to honoring all people and having all people feel seen and heard, because so much of the isms that we're dealing with, whether it's racism or sexism, it's all coming from a fear that if I have, you won't have.
Yeah, I think Carrie's voice will be particularly important in the next few years, because even once we get people vaccinated and the pandemic in a certain sense is over, the deficits on learning where the mm-hmm. inner city, the Black students have been affected far more mm-hmm. than other students, you know, the inner city businesses, the mental health challenges, it's going to take many years to remedy those things. So shining light on the heroes, you know, some cases where things have gone well, and the human story of, you know, we all suffered through this together, but some are still paying a price for it. It'll be interesting if that can draw us together. You know, after World War II, we did come together. Is this one, are we going to have a sense, okay, we conquered the health problem, let's go after these deficits, which sadly have struck along all the lines of inequity mm-hmm. that pre-existed the pandemic.
What do you think, Bill? And like, how do you feel about the role of artists when it comes to social change?
It's amazing how the issues that I work on can disappear. Mm. You know, particularly if they're over in Africa, it's, you know, just not that visible. And usually when you have a crisis, people do kind of turn inwards. Mm. The financial crisis did that a bit. Now with the pandemic, it'll be interesting to see. You know, when I first met Bono, I didn't understand how critical he would be to the work that we were doing, and even making it fun and bringing energy to it. You know, the true mm-hmm. activists can get discouraged. And so the fact that you mm-hmm. reach out to them and you highlight them and you praise them, I wouldn't underestimate the value of that, because, you know, they're out there on the fringe doing the super hard work. So yes, by embracing those people, by telling the stories, including some of success, that arc of justice is definitely accelerated by artists having these values.
That's excellent advice.
It's good to hear.
Yeah, that's good. Because I do think that sometimes we lose sight of that, but sometimes it is just helping to increase morale, you know, and create community mm-hmm. when people just are tired. People are tired.
That's right. Know? That's right. And that's fun to remember also, because it's sometimes in these moments we think like, how can I help the legal battles? Right. How can I be registering voters? Like all of these things that are not exactly what I'm best at. So it's great for me to jump in and lend a hand and increase visibility, but also like, what stories can I tell? How can I bring joy? How can I bring inspiration to a moment? Yes, that's actually what I do.
Yeah.
It's good to remember.
Carrie, it's such a pleasure to know you and to talk to you today. And thank you so much for joining us.
I'm delighted to spend time with you both, as I'm a super fan of you both.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Bye.
That was super.
Yeah.
It's nice that for them, when they measure their success, they think of not just how great they performed their art, but have they brought their values to play, that's part of who they are. Mm. And they'd feel strange to have commercial success without it connecting to their values. And I think we'll see more of that. You know, young people are yearning for guidance on how to do more than just have financial success.
Right.
And I think artists can connect this next generation with causes that will both be fulfilling and accelerate progress.
Right.
You know, it's my optimism is showing here again.
Bono talked about how you had this kind of singular vision, and that's kind of what's great about you and your work. What do you think is the more important trait, to be open to change or to have a sense of this kind of like thread of conviction through the course of your life?
Well, there are movements. Movements need quite a mix of characters. But I could not have sat down with Senator Helms and convinced him not to block the money for HIV in the way that Bono did, by quoting from the Bible and creating a sense of common humanity. Hmm. That's, you know, actually pretty phenomenal that Bono has that skill. So, you know, all movements need different folks, and hopefully those folks do like working as a team and find that common cause. And that's why it was fun to have Bono, you know, who comes at this from a different angle than I do, and yet we've resonated with each other.
In general, would you say you've changed more than you haven't over the course of your life?
I think there's limits to how much people can change. You can mellow, you can learn other people's points of view, and you can give your kids a chance to be more enlightened than you are.
Right. The change, you can see the change generationally. That feels like the big one.
A lot of the big change, sadly, requires generations to go by, you know, before you don't think of the Japanese as this enemy that we fought, and you see them as deeply peace-loving.
But that, I think the big answer there is that change requires you to kind of really see other people and see the big picture of something. It's impossible to envision change when you're just like sitting in your own life and just seeing what you're seeing day to day. You have to think big. You have to think globally. You have to think generationally. Change requires so much energy and time to really stick. So we have to be patient and thoughtful and evolved and empathetic. That's all I got to say.
All right.
So over this season, our series has explored questions that are fundamentally about change. Can and should we stop lying? Can society become more equal? Will things be different after COVID-19? Can we make the changes needed to stop a climate disaster? And it seems to me that your optimism, Bill, is rooted in change and the belief that things will get better because people choose to make them better and have the tools to make them better. So I want to ask you one last time, why should I be an optimist? Why should I believe that the world is changing for the better?
Well, if you look at the world 200 years ago, you know, a third of all children died before the age of five. And, you know, we didn't have electricity. We didn't have communications. You know, most people in the world were not literate. So there has been this trend. It gets interrupted by wars or pandemics like the one we're experiencing right now. But the basic through line is that we learn together, even in politics, the idea that the safety net should be more generous over time. Both parties slowly but surely have taken the extra riches and tried to be a bit more fair about sharing that. So, you know, I can't guarantee that it won't be a zigzag, but between innovation and people's basic humanity, yes, I think the trend of the past we'll see, even during our lifetime, healthier, safer, somewhat more equitable world.
Okay. Well, that's going to have to be proven to me.
Good. No, you'll be so excited.
I hope so.
Because your expectations are
low.
That's
They're
what Warren
low.
Buffett always says about marriage, is that the key is to go into it with low expectations, because you'll be impressed by modest acts of kindness.
Or deeply suspicious. So in terms of the world changing, okay, I might buy that. But my concern is that we live in a very young country. We live in this experiment that could be a failure, and we could be staring down the barrel of watching the failure unravel in front of us. Why am I supposed to believe that America will continue to get better?
Well, America's gone through several hundred years, including a civil war, a depression, two world wars, and you would have been scared at many of those points in time that we were off track. And yet, we've done better. You know, poverty, education, we've improved those things. And so why would our generation be the one where the basic idea of democracy falls apart? Yes, we need to stay involved to make it work, but I don't see any problem harder than the ones that were faced by our ancestors.
Even if it doesn't feel like things are getting better, the fact that the problems are less grave means that things are getting better.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to have another civil war. And I don't think we're going to have...
You don't?
Nope. Civil war is a bad thing. I don't think we'll have more world wars. We had some bad episodes, and I believe that we've learned from them.
I worry about the giant wealth gap. That's what I worry, and the climate crisis. Those are my two things that I'm concerned about people not being able to fix or wanting to fix, because people really like being rich, even if it's at the expense of other people being poor.
Well, fortunately, it's not a zero-sum game. There has been more wealth, and there will be more wealth. Yes, we should spread it around somewhat more equally without destroying the incentive system, so we don't want to go too far. But yeah, even there, I'm an optimist.
Okay. I don't want to end this on a negative note as we go into the holidays.
Well, then you're going to have to let me do the talking.
Okay. You go for it.
Hey, This is the upbeat podcast from Bill and Rashida. Season one, we solved big problems for you.
We solved them, apparently. We didn't solve them, but we did get into them in a way that I think people...
We gave people something to think about. Hopefully,
yeah.
Some young people listening in will be part of the solution.
Yes, I think I have faith in the next generation, and I have faith that having these conversations in a public way will help us to solve the problems. So that's hopeful, right?
Very.
Can we just talk? Can we just talk about where we're going before we get lost?
Bill Gates and Rashida Jones Ask Big Questions is a production of The Gates Notes. It is written and produced by me and Bill. Thank you to our guests Bono and Kerry Washington for joining us today. Our creative director is Ian Saunders. Our supervising producers are Jen Krajicek, Pia Deerking, and David Sanger. Our design director is Anu Horseman. Our technical director is Alicia Salmond. And our researcher is Brent Christofferson. Thank you to executive producers Lauren Sporer, Phoebe Judge, Bridget Arnold, and Nick Mosseri. Co-executive producers Kara Brown and Megan Grube. And producers Carl Malone and Nadia Wilson. Special thanks to Larry Cohen. Audio mix by Rob Byers, Michael Raphael, and Johnny Vince Evans. And recording by Joel Barham. Galen Huckins is our composer. Our theme song is Talk by Khalid. To learn more about the topic you heard today, visit gatesnotes.com. Subscribe to Bill Gates and Rashida Jones Ask Big Questions on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts.